This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, we're under another sky in Roman Britain with Charlotte Higgins, and then Seth Mnookin shares his love for Richard Stark's Parker novels. Before we begin this week, a quick message from our sponsors. We all love books, right? That's why you're listening to this podcast. But books can be a pain sometimes. They're heavy, you have to hold them. Perhaps you're driving, you're not allowed to read when you're driving. Or perhaps you're going, I don't know, jogging or something. Wouldn't it be better to have somebody read a book directly into your ear? Well, you're in luck. Little Atoms has teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choosing. All you have to do is register for a 1 month free trial to claim your free audiobook, and there's over 80,000 to choose from. For instance, by remarkable coincidence, you can choose Under Another Sky by Charlotte Higgins, which you're about to listen to us talk about for an hour. The 30-day free trial means that you can choose a free audiobook which is yours to keep, whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. So get yourself to www.audible.co.uk/littleatoms, the little atoms bit is all one word, and get your free book. And best of all, if you sign up, I get a gift from Audible in the form of cold hard cash, so you're helping to keep the show running as well, which is nice. Anyway, where were we? Charlotte Higgins studied classics at Balliol College, Oxford, and is The Guardian's chief arts writer. She is the author of a number of books, including Latin Love Lessons and It's All Greek to Me, and her latest is Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain, which has just recently come out in paperback from Vintage, and which was shortlisted for the 2013 Samuel Johnson Prize. So, Charlotte, thanks for talking to me on Little Atoms, first of all.
Thank you very much for having me.
The first thing I'd like to know before we actually get into the meat of the book is, why this book? Why now?
Do you know, it's one of those slightly weird things where it wasn't actually my idea, and so this is almost like it's a confession. Mm-hmm. It was my agent said to me, in his very gruff way, he's not a particularly voluble man. He tends to issue kind of gruff little remarks, and he said, why don't you write a book about walking around Roman Britain? Full stop, end of. And I thought, what does that mean? And then I sort of put it in my pipe and smoked it and thought, actually, do you know what? I can do something with that idea. I'd just come back from walking along Hadrian's Wall, in fact. So there was a sort of real impetus for it. And I had been very inspired by Hadrian's Wall. We'll perhaps talk about it later. But it's just, in terms of the way it sits in its landscape, it's extraordinary. And I became interested in all sorts of questions about how the monument had existed for the past 2,000 years. In other words, since the end of Roman rule, as well as during Roman rule. So those questions, and you know, I just felt I could, I don't know, I just felt there was something I could do that was about place as well as time. And I began to devise a plan that involved travelling around the country in search of these Roman remains, perhaps slightly in the spirit of antiquarians in the past. Mm-hmm. But it would also be a way for me to discover my own country a bit, you know, to filter my view of Britishness and Britain through this one idea. So that's how it began to take shape. And of course, as you said, I mean, I'm a classicist, so I am really interested in this stuff. But there was this other part of it as well, which was that, you know, when I studied classics, Roman Britain was not part of that at all. It was all about the glories of the Mediterranean. And, you know, frankly, I was much more interested in the Mediterranean because, you know, I remember as a student, I got a little scholarship. We all got little scholarships to go and have some fun in a place of antique interest. And that was not going to be Cumbria. You know, that was, I spent quite a lot of time hanging out in Rome, and that was really fantastic, eating pizza and drinking red wine. You know, for me, the classical world was all about that. And Roman Britain was this dreary thing that I'd been dragged to on school trips, and I didn't really think about it at all. I suppose on some level it was to do with reading books by people like Roger Deakin and Robert McFarlane as well, and thinking about a particular kind of vision of this country, what's my way of thinking about it, and sort of rediscovering for myself this Romanness, which is a bit of a lost historical period in a funny way. It's a 400-year period. It's really long. And yet we don't, you know, we have very little idea of it in all sorts of ways.
Well, I really think the idea that, you know, you look at plays and a sense of plays through the book is what's so great about it. And it is, it's really difficult to grasp often because, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about Roman London, which is a place where, you know, famously is, you know, it's an old Roman town, and yet there's very little, and it's very difficult to get a grasp on what Roman London was like. And then there's somewhere like the first place I want to talk in detail about, which is Silchester, which you describe in the book as this, you know, sort of lost Sylvan sort of place that really gives you not just a, I guess, a view of what Roman Britain might have been like, but a view of it as an ancient, as a past, because it's a place that's just gone.
For me, you know, Silchester was all about irrecoverability. If I had one idea that I was trying to think about in the chapter I wrote about Silchester, it was just how impossible this problem is, how impossible it is to grasp the past. Mm-hmm. So Silchester is a Roman site in Hampshire. It's not far from Aldermaston, with its extraordinary kind of nuclear kind of defence scenario going on with, you know, barbed wire fences and kind of secrecy. That's a very strange place. Not far from all that, in the middle of these sort of astonishing, deep, beautiful kind of hedgerowed lanes, very hard to find, very ill signposted, and significantly has always been incredibly hard to find. You read 18th century accounts moaning about how impossible it is to find. You read the sort of wonderful, now out of print, sort of standard gazetteer of Roman Britain also moaning about how difficult it is to find. Disso, we also found it incredibly difficult to find. And once you're there, in a curious sense, there's not that much to see. What there is a set of enclosing walls. So there are town walls, and then in the middle of the town walls, there is pasture. And if you gaze in the right sort of light at this pasture in the mm-hmm. centre of the walls, you can see, as if it's a distant object underneath the water surface of the sea, you can see gradations in the colour of the grass that look like, and in fact are signs of, a town plan of walls. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly ungraspable. I mean, it's barely there. And, you know, the idea that you sort of see it, if you get your eye in and the light's in the right place, and it's like a sort of wreck under the water. So, you know, how underwhelming, you might say. But there's something incredibly numinous about this place, partly because it's, you know, you're in this beautiful wooded landscape. When I went, it was midsummer, and it was sort of thick bird song all around. These beautiful ash trees and oak trees, this flinty stone walls. And then actually stuff like, actually quite a well-preserved, as it happens, amphitheatre. So there is a little bit more to see than I've just described. When you walk into the amphitheatre, it is slightly Puck of Pook's Hillish. I mean, you do, you know, by this time you're so sort of enthralled to this whole sylvan thing that you describe that you think, you know, some Roman soldier is going to pop up any minute. So it's a place that has extraordinary atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But, and, you know, archaeologists work on it every year. It's incredibly well studied. There's been a 30-year dig that's been going on every summer from the University of Reading. And the wonderful man, Professor Mike Fulford, in charge of that excavation, we talked a lot about, you know, his vision of what that town might have been like. And yeah, I suppose I'm just full of the knowledge of how historically contingent any archaeologist's view of mm-hmm. what something might be like yeah. is. And, you know, very learned, interesting people in the 19th century had rather different ideas from Mike of what it might actually have mm-hmm. been like. So, you know, it's that sort of sense of it slips out of your fingers. And there's an important fictional account of Silchester which comes in the wonderful children's book, The Eagle of the Ninth, by Rosemary Sutcliffe, part of which is set in Silchester. Mm-hmm. And the eagle, which is supposed to be the lost legionary standard of the Ninth Legion, she was inspired by a little bronze sculpture of an eagle that was discovered in Silchester and is now in the Reading Museum. And bits of that book are set in Silchester. Now, she has this incredibly clear vision of what Roman Britain is like, and she said in interviews that she felt that she would be completely at home in Roman Britain. She knew what they had for breakfast. Mm-hmm. After a couple of days, she would be fine. She would know how, if she was transported there, she would know how to get around the place. Now, I just never, ever, ever felt that. Part of my fascination with it is the ungraspability mm-hmm. of and the historical contingency of our own views of Silchester, and I found myself thinking very differently about it from the novelist view, where of course you flesh out and you invent and you create an internally consistent world. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was never in a position to do that. So for me, it was all about silence and strangeness and our inability to understand it.
I'm Danny Dorling, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
But it was a garrison town, a town sort of on the, you know, on the route of various Roman garrison towns going up into the country. And so obviously, you know, for the people that were manning that town, it wouldn't have been this lovely countryside, so, you know, lovely sylvan place with, you know, birds singing and lovely leafy lanes. It would have been, like, you know, a dangerous and violent place. So let's talk about what did those people, what do we know of what the Romans thought of being in Britain? So there's writing of Tacitus, and you mentioned somebody who I hadn't heard of before, Cassius Dio as well, who sounds like he should be leading up a heavy metal band or something. But they you know, they wrote, and at that point as well, contrasting ideas of what. So even at the time, pretty much contemporary writers had, you know, contentious ideas of what life was like in Britain and you know, what life was like for the Roman soldiers.
Exactly. And you've already touched implicitly on one thing, one important thing, which is the archaeology tells us a slightly different story from the historians. So, you know, if you would talk to Mike Fulford, he would tell you about quite a cosmopolitan place, very much at a crossroads, Silchester, possibly with quite a lot of Gaulish influence. The Iron Age, you know, British people there as well. It was a crossroads to all, you know, it would lead you to Bath, it would lead you down south, it would lead you back to London. There's a network of roads. Any military folk passing through to the west would have gone through it. So quite a busy, vibrant place, but still very hard to interpret and understand. There are lots of weird things about Silchester, notably dog sacrifice, possibly. Lots of dogs buried at crossroads, apparently flayed or perhaps having been subjected to some kind of ritual death. Really peculiar, very hard to understand. These are really, this is alien, God knows, you know. But the to turn to what the Romans wrote about Britain, to make a very general point, it's a thread that runs through Roman writing about Britain. The Romans were very invested in the weirdness, the isolation, the strangeness, the liminal nature of Britain. So the way the classical world, this again, this is a very crude way of explaining it and thinking about it, but it's broadly true. There is a sort of sense that the world consists of bands of concentric circles, with Rome and Athens more or less at its centre. The further out you get from those nodal places in the centre, the weirder things become. Roman Britain is absolutely on the fringe. You know, it is the far northwest point of the Roman Empire. And it is described ethnographically in fairly similar terms, in fact, to, you know, people in Scythia, or which is sort of the steppes of Russia, or sub-Saharan Africa. So there's a sort of similar kind of oddness, peculiarity and danger to those kind of places. They are absolutely on the fringes. So perhaps the most eloquent writing about this is from Tacitus, although Julius Caesar did a jolly good job as well. Tacitus writes about Britain as if it has a sort of noble purity about it, as well as the peculiarity of this misty place where it gets very dark in the winter and the water behaves in a very peculiar way. You know, this is not the Mediterranean, this is the North Sea. There are weird things going on with tides. The water has a kind of gelatinous feel to it. There are these sudden mists. So all of that kind of, you know, this is all about strangeness and peculiarity. The people who inhabit the country are in some ways noble and in some ways savages. So the other dynamic that is going on, if you're Tacitus, what is running through your writing is about the moral corruption of the empire and the fact that it's all gone morally wrong.
Yeah. So Britain is a metaphor to him as well.
Exactly, exactly. Now, you know, the further out from this corrupt centre you get, the less corrupted you are. So in a funny way, Britain provides a stage set for his Roman characters to be the kind of Romans they need to be, far away from the centre. And Tacitus gives his Roman characters, he wrote his father-in-law's biography, and it's a very heroising account. He gives his father-in-law Agricola, worthy enemies. And what that does in the end, that all comes back to roost, because these accounts by Tacitus and Julius Caesar and Cassius Dio and others are so influential in the way that, you know, later British people start to think about the past. Mm-hmm. So when these texts are rediscovered and thought about, you know, broadly in the humanist period, so late 16th century, mm-hmm. and Britain starts being about history rather than mythography, mm-hmm. those texts start to inform the way we think about ourselves. And the heroic figures, Boudicca and Caractacus and others, you know, become very important figures for us. So there's a kind of way in which these Roman ideas about Britishness, which, you know, you have to remember also the Romans were the first to write about Britain. Mm-hmm. The Greeks wrote about Britain a tiny bit. But the Romans are the, you know, this is the first literature about Britain. And that kind of sense of writing the islands into being and having a kind of a version of what this Britishness might consist of, that starts with the Romans. And I just find that very exciting. I still find it exciting.
And me too. And I wanted to bring up Boudicca or Boudicca, or however we're supposed to pronounce it, this week. Being someone who at the moment hails from East Anglia, you know, I wanted to bring up the Iceni and Boudicca's rout of London eventually. And I just find that fascinating, this idea that, you know, Boudicca is someone who has become, as you said, like a modern Britannia, somebody who, you know, who we now deem it acceptable to see as a great British historical figure, a rebel against Rome and against imperialism. And yet, of course, we only know of her through the writings of Roman.
Right, exactly. And as I've just said, you know, it's important for... It's Tacitus who first writes about Boudicca, and it's important for Boudicca to be a worthy enemy of his Romans. Mm-hmm. So she has certain virtues. She also has, in his account, extremely savage instincts. And, you know, she is a sort of terrorist, a guerrilla fighter, and a very nasty, violent piece of work. So there are sort of two things going on. You know, it's always sort of oppositional. But, you know, he's writing a generation and a half after she died. It's simply not pure invention, you know. His source was the governor of Britain, so we can probably, let's hope, rely to a certain extent on that account. Cassius Dio, who's writing 150 years later or so, gives an extraordinarily embellished account of Boudicca, where it all gets everything Tacitus has intimated about these kind of weird, savage, but sort of vaguely admirable Britons gets ramped up. Mm-hmm. So when Cassius Dio writes about Boudicca, she's a sort of astonishing figure with this long blonde hair and this kind of, you know, kind of vicious gaze, and she gives a speech. So classical authors like to give their characters, historical characters, speeches. It's a part of historiography that doesn't really exist anymore, and is quite confusing to figure out what status these speeches have. You know, sometimes, you know, it's possible that the historian was there and could have understood and known what speech is being given, but in many cases they seem to be some kind of act of ventriloquism, and it's fairly uncertain what sort of status they have as sort of truth, or whether that is the wrong way of looking at it altogether. However, the point is, Roman historians and Greek historians give their great leaders speeches to deliver from time to time. And Boudicca is given a speech to deliver in Cassius Dio's account of her rebellion. And it's sort of marvellous as almost a caricature of Roman views of the British savage. She says, well, the problem with these Romans is that, you know, they can't live without olive oil and bread and wine. We are so marvellous and so tough that we just live on water. And, you know, those Romans are so... you know, they're kind of led by this kind of incredibly feminine man, Nero, who's more interested in applying makeup and playing the lyre. And we're properly tough people. And then she says, and we can't really be conquered because we live almost in another world under another sky, which is where the title of the book comes Indeed. From. And there's a sort of, you know, when you start to unpick that, there's all this strange displacement and doubling and who's saying what about whom that I find very attractive and very compelling. But The Under Another Sky thing was, you know, I suppose it became for me about displacement, both geographical and, well, I suppose displacement isn't the right word when it comes to time, but it was about time and place, both at the same time. So Boudicca became a kind of hero of sorts in later British writing, and she becomes someone to whom you might compare any female ruler. So Elizabeth I has a kind of Boudicca moment. Mm-hmm. Queen Victoria has a Boudicca moment, such that there's the wonderful sculpture of her galloping in her chariot next to the Houses of Parliament, which is a direct reference to Queen Victoria. And now, in modern Colchester, which celebrates Boudicca, there are things like the Queen Boudicca Primary School, okay, and there's a statue of her, the early 20th century statue of her in the facade of the town hall and so on. And this is all very peculiar in so many ways because, well, for a start, she's a very unstable figure to have as a hero.
It's like somewhere in Poland having a school named after Hitler or something.
Well, a bit, except that the way we understand Boudicca, she always has these positive qualities as well. And also, it's about femininity. I mean, the important thing is, if you're Queen Elizabeth or Queen Victoria, just as it's now very difficult for women to have, you know, what are the templates if you're a powerful woman? Well, you know, what do you do? You go back through history and find a template. Okay, Boudicca looks a bit like a plausible template, except not. You know, there's this sort of rejection, embracing of Boudicca as a model and rejection of her at the same time, because you can't, you know, and that exemplifies in a way the difficulties of female rule, that there aren't these kind of ancestor figures that you can easily pluck out. Boudicca is not a simple figure. And the this is wonderfully comical, in a way, thing about her being adopted as more or less a patron saint of Colchester is that, you know, she did one thing in Colchester, and that was burn it to the ground and kill everybody in it. I mean, the primary school, Neil, the primary school is named after this woman. So it's fascinating that somebody, after I, you know, lots of things happen after you publish a book, so lots of people write to you and tell you interesting things. Someone sent me, I hadn't known about this, somebody sent me a picture of a really, really ugly municipal sculpture of Boudicca in the middle of a roundabout in Colchester as well. So there are all these sort of, you know, Boudicca's absolutely everywhere in Colchester. She slaughtered the entire town.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Charlotte Higgins, and we're talking about her book, Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain. And Charlotte, we've just left Boudicca burning down and slaughtering everybody in Colchester, and of course, she goes on to top that by burning down and slaughtering everybody in London as well. Now, I mentioned in the first part the idea of, you know, Rome and London as being something that's quite elusive. There are little tiny bits of the wall. In fact, Rome and London is more visible in London, I guess, just by the names of places as well, by the names of the Old Gate and Cripple Gate and the various other gates, and there's bits of the wall, London Wall, and various street names around the city. Let's talk about what is there. There's the one particular thing that I was completely unaware of that you go and visit. There's various things that you can see in city buildings, in underground car parks and things, but there is one, a villa. Tell us about that, the villa that you went to see that was locked up and locked away.
Yeah, like you say, Roman London is elusive, and there are things that you can find if you are determined to do so. The best of these is a waterside, well, villa's perhaps not quite the right word, but it might have been some kind of inn, certainly some kind of dwelling place, that was on the banks of the river, which means now, because of the shape of the river has changed, become narrower, that it's a block away from the river in the city of London. And at the time that I went to see, okay, so it's underneath and accessible from a modern office block, owned, I think, by the Man Group, or certainly was when I visited it, as in the Man Booker Prize, I noted. And it's a very peculiar setup because they had, at one point, anticipated opening it up to the public. So it had a kind of glass, proper little entrance, a glass sliding door, And then you went into an anteroom, and it was, but nothing was decorated, and it was all as if half finished, and there were various sort of health and safety signs. And you flicked on a light, or rather I didn't, but the very nice woman from the Museum of London who was, showed me it, flicked on a light, and there was this sort of scuttling, and it was rats. And you thought, oh, Christ. And then we went down some metal steps, and she flicked on some more switches, and she showed me this very pretty well-preserved house with a particularly very well-preserved bath. So it might, so the thought was it could have been some kind of riverside hostelry of some kind. But like a lot of those remains, it has, in the City of London, it has a curious relationship with what's going on top, which is the City of London with all its commerce and money-making. And one finds that I did this very curious exercise, which was to go to the wonderful Museum of London archive, or rather storage facility, where they keep the stuff that is not on view in the museum. And you can, it's essentially, you know, they have shoe boxes full of stuff. Often it's very, to our eyes, our layperson's eyes, very boring stuff like bits of charred tile or, you know, brick, not very exciting. And there it is, all in boxes on big metal shelves and all sorted by year. And you could chart the fortunes of the city's economy by counting these boxes. So when the city is booming and there's a lot of building in the city, concomitantly, the number of excavations increases and there are more boxes. After the 1989 crash, for example, in 1990-91, development obviously slowed to a more or less a standstill and there are almost no boxes. It's a very peculiar relationship. And there's this sort of sense that that's what London's always been like, because we don't know that much about Roman London, except that it is Roman. I mean, that's not to say there weren't Iron Age people. We don't really know this, but there were probably Iron Age people living around, because there are fine Iron Age and Bronze Age and Stone Age finds from around the London area. But in terms of it becoming a town, a city, you know, it's a Roman invention, probably to do with what was the most conveniently navigable part of the Thames and so on and so forth. And although the Romans are very careful at assigning functions to towns and giving them, and so you tend to know what kind of town it was from bureaucratic records, we don't really know what kind of town London was, except that it is described by Tacitus as being a town that was full of commerce and business and very busy with trade. And you think, well, there's a piece of continuity, you know. And that's, to that extent, London has not really changed its nature, although it lay empty for hundreds of years after the end of Roman rule, creepily. You know, the idea that there was this walled city, deserted, that the Saxons weren't actually particularly interested in. The Saxons preferred to dwell in the suburbs, so in sort of Norwood and Croydon.
Well, the other way that you can see the changing fortune of modern London through the eyes of a Roman antiquity is the ongoing story of what happened to the temple of Mithras that was discovered. So tell us about what that is, first of all, and then just what's happened to it over the last, since its discovery.
Well, this was another find that was made when a building was going up. So in the 50s, I think it was the Legal and General building, which was a not unattractive pair of modernist slabs, went up around Victoria Street down there in the City of London and found the Temple of Mithras, which became sensational, you know, because the whole idea of Mithras is so exciting. You know, this is a mystical sort of Persian-inflected religion with strange rituals, and it really caught the imagination when it was discovered and you know, hundreds of thousands of people visited the site. But then there was this problem, you know, remember we are in austerity London at the time, post-war. You know, money is tight. What to do about the fact that we have found this temple? It was judged too expensive to completely change the plans of the new building, so they decided to move the Temple of Mithras and redisplay it in a slightly different site. And so in our lifetime, Neil, you could see the Temple of Mithras outside this building, and archaeologists would shudder at the sight of it because they knew that it had been taken down and put up with perhaps slightly less care than it ought to have been. So it was a slightly bit of an invented thing. That's putting it a bit strongly, but it was perhaps there wasn't quite enough care taken, and I think it sort of made some archaeologists a bit squeamish, to be honest. So then, as happens, you know, these buildings in the City of London have a shorter and shorter shelf life. So after 40 or 50 years, these buildings are over and done with, you know, pulled down, redeveloped. So that's what's happened with this building. Has been destroyed. There's a new Norman Foster complex going up. Cue the opportunity, actually, for some very interesting archaeology to happen around the real site of the Mithraic temple. And what will eventually happen, although because of our own recent economic travails, this is all happening rather later than anyone anticipated, and it's much delayed, the poor old temple of Mithras will find a new home on what was its original site a bit later on. I mean, all this source of material was a bit of a revelation to me, because, you know, you see the ruin, don't you, or the monument, the historical monument, and think, yes, terribly interesting. And you don't tend to think, well, the funny thing about that is it's been moved 50 yards, and you know, those kind of funny histories about how they've become tourist attractions or how they've been preserved or not preserved are not necessarily part of our thinking, and I found that sort of terribly fascinating.
The other thing that I think is constantly surprising is how modern London, although often, as I said, the, you know, Roman London remains in the street plan and in the street names, and bits of the wall every now and then, but how modern London is just basically built on top of Roman London, but so much of it remains. It is literally 3 metres underground or something. There exists Roman streets and various other bits. And as I said, there's a great picture in the book of a piece of the wall in a car park with a motorbike parked next to it. It's just in the, you know, the multi-storey car park under another tower block. So
yeah, that's right next to the Barbican. And that the reason that was revealed, that stretch of wall, which is pretty well preserved, but it's in this underground car park. You have to walk quite a long way under the car park. It's because of the Blitz. So the other way that Roman London gets revealed is when modern London is destroyed. So tons of Roman London was suddenly revealed itself in the Blitz. So that is a very peculiar relationship, I think. There's something very sort of haunting about that idea. The other time, you know, when the sewers were being built in the 19th century, but this is before rescue archaeology. I mean, but the navvies, the workmen, were cutting through Roman stuff all the time. And the City of London, the corporation, the authorities were not interested. And as so often in these cases, a passionate amateur, one of my favourite characters, a pharmacist called Charles Roach Smith, who was a pretty monomaniacal lover of Roman things, did his best to document the stuff, buy stuff from the navvies, save as much as he could, and that forms the basis of the really great Roman collection in the Museum of London. But yes, there's so much down there waiting for some cataclysm, waiting for the nuclear bombs to fall.
I'm Molly Oldfield, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You mentioned there one of the characters. There's numerous characters that crop up through this book, through the history of going right back to early antiquity, and then, you know, the first of the flowering of antiquarians and the first archaeologists. And you've already mentioned Rosemary Sutcliffe. I wanted to talk perhaps a little bit about some of the people that have used Roman Britain in fiction, in art. But, let's look at some of those characters. The first person I want to bring up, you mentioned, I think, in the first part, this idea of our ideas of Roman Britain once upon a time being just like, you know, just myth. And I want to talk about Geoffrey of Monmouth, who is this fantastic character that recurs time and time again. I don't want to call him a historian, really, because he just made shit up, it seemed.
He's a wonderful storyteller. So, yeah, Geoffrey of Monmouth, yes, I think it's safe not to call him a historian. He was a wonderful, wonderful storyteller, and he wrote a book called A History of the Kings of Britain, and he claimed that he had sort of he was drawing on a historical source. So he claimed that he was drawing on knowledge from a very old book, which is one of those lovely distancing techniques, isn't it? It's like the turn of the screw. Somebody told me this and I have it on good authority. So it's consciously or unconsciously, it's a fantastic fictional device. And in that, but I mean, if you haven't read it, dear listener, then you must, because it's a font of all the great stories. I mean, it's, you know, it's got King Lear in it, you know, pretty much verbatim, and lots of good stuff. He weaves stories about Roman Britain that have a kind of hint or a nudge of truthfulness in them. Or so he talks about King Cole, for example, who is supposedly the, we think is probably, his name comes from a corruption of the word Colchester. He talks about Constantine the Great and his mother Helen, and weaves sort of wonderful stories about that. So, well, and also, interestingly, he creates this wonderful etiological myth for the foundation of Britain, which is the idea that there's this character called Brutus who, as an exile from Troy, after Troy had been sacked by the Greeks, this figure Brutus, not mentioned in Virgil, by the way, or Homer, makes his way to Britain and founds this race. Okay, so that is a sort of echo of the Aeneid, the Virgil's poem that in which Aeneas escapes the smouldering remains of Troy and founds Italy. So Geoffrey is giving Britain this grand mythical origin that looks a bit like the Aeneid. Mm-hmm. And we never talk about that anymore. And it's, you know, it's, there's something sort of, it's complete fantasy, but it's sort of wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a family tree. I think I'm right in saying that the Magus John Dee, who was the astrologer of Elizabeth I, wrote her a family tree that suggested her ancestry went directly back to Brutus. So all of that is very rich and strange and lovely. And there are sort of bits and bobs of Romanness in Geoffrey of Monmouth, but it's basically story. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, fast forward a few centuries, you then get this brilliant, significant, wonderful figure called William of Camden, mm-hmm. called, not William of Camden, just simply called William Camden, forgive me, who...
He used to hang around the good mixer all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And he travels around Britain, collecting its antiquities, not, I mean, you know, sort of recording and thinking about the antiquities and trying to marry up what he saw with what texts were now becoming readily available. You know, we're talking about the relatively fresh and exciting technology of print and manuscripts, antique manuscripts that are coming out of being sort of dusted off from libraries in continental Europe. And so suddenly there's a lot more knowledge going around about what might really have happened in Britain. And, that, and of course the Magus, you know, there's not tons of texts from Saxon or, nor, you know, Norse Britain. The major sources of knowledge about early Britain are Roman. So Camden's very, very important because he's, you know, he's aligning monuments, places, things, you know, inscriptions, ruins with text and starting to think about history, start using the word history rigorously in a way that we certainly can't with Geoffrey. You know, he's a sort of great father figure for British historiography and archaeology as well.
Leaping even further forward then to the 20th century and, you know, after the, you know, the birth of proper investigative archaeology, this is at the point where, I guess, the same time that Carter's over in Egypt and the big boom of archaeology is going on. There's this incredible figure that I want to introduce, but I think the book again, because I put the bookmark in at the exact quote.
Mortimer Wheeler.
Yes, I want you to read the quote about Mortimer Wheeler from his biographer.
By Jocasta Hawkes, the fabulous Jocasta Hawkes.
Which is just...
Mrs. J.B. Priestley.
Astonishing.
Yeah, so Jocasta Hawkes, who's a great figure, she's in that... she's one of the figures in Rachel Cook's book about women in the 50s, which I've not yet read, but she's a very interesting figure, Jocasta Hawkes. And she wrote the biography of Mortimer Wheeler, who was this very swashbuckling pioneer archaeologist who lived through both wars, you know, and worked through both wars. And she described him thus. Women were of immense importance to him, and he enjoyed and made use of them in a marvellous variety of ways. Young girls, including, I have been told, the domestics of at least one country house. Women he met on his innumerable cruises and other travels. Any who were attractive, light-hearted, and unlikely to interfere with his work. Exceptional young women with fine looks, and with the character, vitality, and temperament to offer the resistance, flint to his steel, that he needed to kindle his fires. I mean, it sounds a bit rapey, doesn't it? It's really disturbing. It's like, you needed them to say no. And basically, this typology of women is like anyone in a skirt and with a pair of breasts.
He made use of them in many marvellous ways.
It's just somebody, I mean, he was so notorious for this womanising. When I went around Colchester with a wonderful archaeologist called Philip Crummy, he had many a tale about Mortimer Wheeler, including Mortimer had excavated in Colchester. You remember going around Colchester with Mortimer, and he was quite an old man, and he sort of ran into this woman in the streets, and the woman just burst into floods of tears and ran away, you know. It was this sort of sense that they've broken hearts the length and breadth of Roman Britain.
And we're laughing about this. What's really tragic about this story is the actual, as is often the case at this time, his wife, Tessa, was also, you know, was basically the power behind the throne and more impressive archaeologist, basically ran all of his digs and did all of his accounts and did all the work, but also, you know, became a serious, renowned archaeologist herself.
Yeah, she was a very clever woman. She went to university. They met at University College London. You know, she had got into university shortly before the First World War. They fell in love and got married quite quickly. You know, she was a bright soul, but, you know, she was a sort of helpmeet to Mortimer, and that she threw herself into his work. But because she was clever and talented and interested and sharp, she became an expert in her own right and ultimately became one of the first women to be elected to be Fellow of the Society of Antiquaries. And at a certain point, when Mortimer, his career really took off and he was asked to run museums and so forth, and she ended up taking on in her own right some of the digs that he couldn't complete. But you really get the sense of, you know, I have to remember also he's a military man. He had two good wars, you know. There's a connection between military life in a way and this archaeological life.
Mm-hmm. Trenches. Well, I mean, his experience in the First World War, particularly, I wanted to bring up. Because it seems like that was the defining experience of his life.
Yeah. But in a much more less metaphorical way, you know, you turn up and you've got a gang of squaddies and they have to do what you tell them. And she was like the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
She made everything happen. And, you know, she was loved. I mean, that's the thing. You know, in a book that is slightly scarce of women, apart from Boudicca, just because of the nature of the beast, you know, there weren't a load of 18th century women antiquaries. I became very fond of Tessa. She was loved, and the accounts of her by younger archaeologists, mm-hmm. you know, who went on to become very serious and important people. You know, she was kind of worshipped. She was a kind, knowledgeable, rather wonderful woman who made things work. And to be honest, you know, Mortimer Wheeler was a very significant figure. He was a huge popularizer of archaeology. He was on the telly a lot when the television age arrived. He was a founding figure of the Institute of Archaeology at the University of London, as was Tessa. You know, he's a very significant figure. But he was a shagger.
Mm. While he's off,
I feel a bit sorry for
Tessa. He's off abroad on a dig, doing archaeology and using a young assistant in many marvellous ways.
Mm.
And Tessa tragically dies.
She dies of a botched operation. And she's in her early 40s. And Mortimer comes back from Palestine, where he's been working and shagging. And he is on the boat train. And he opens the Times, and the Times falls open at the obituaries page. And he sees the obituary of his wife, and this is the first he knows. He rings the bell and orders a brandy. I mean, it's a pretty startling thing to think about. He wrote a very vivid autobiography, and this is all told with a certain amount of song fire. It's sort of amazing. But I think you're alluding to that. I did some amateur psychoanalysis of Mortimer Wheeler. Because he writes about these events in his life out of sync. He writes about the death of his wife at the same time as he writes about his experiences, incredibly traumatic experiences, at the Battle of Passchendaele. And I suppose what I write about in the book is how all these events become merged with the dig that they were both engaged in at the time of her death, which was Maiden Castle in Dorset, which is a Iron Age fort, actually, with you know, it was then occupied by Romans, but it's not sort of primarily a Roman site. But in the eventual report that he wrote of the dig at Maiden Castle, which he basically run, he found what he thought was a war cemetery, so evidence of people having been hacked to death by Romans, so to speak. And he writes very vivid, this is a very vivid imagined account of the people rushing out or hurrying out at first light to bury their dead. And, you know, it's sort of all very intense and strange and sort of oddly over-imagined. And for me, it wasn't about, you know, because later archaeology has shown that it's not a war cemetery actually at all, and that this is a huge projection. And it was really all about Passchendaele. And in the autobiography, he talks about the pain of Tessa's death and the pain of Passchendaele sort of emerging and becoming one. So I felt there was a sort of triangulation, rightly or wrongly, and probably wrongly, but that was my interpretation, that the, as I think quite often happens with Roman Britain, there's a whole unconscious level on which there's an internalised level on which we understand it and think about it.
Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Charlotte Higgins, and we're talking about her book Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain. And Charlotte, one of the journeys that you take is walking along the length of Hadrian's Wall. Hadrian's Wall is probably the most famous Roman ruin remain in Britain. And also, my father is from the northeast, so it's something that I'm very familiar with. All of the places that you talked about visiting, I've been to in my childhood, and I have very fond memories of it. Tell us about the walk and, you know, what that's like to actually go along the whole length of it.
Well, it's become this rather wonderful, very gregarious visitor attraction, and I don't mean that in a belittling way. I mean, it's since the part that, you know, there's an official path which was opened up as a celebratory gesture after it was going to open anyway, but it became a celebratory gesture after the sort of devastation of foot and mouth at the beginning of the millennium. And then the Hadrian's Wall path opened up, and suddenly it was a place that visitors were encouraged to come. And I mean, what's become fascinating about it is that, you know, it's part of the post-industrial economy of Britain. So, Neil, when you were growing up and visiting your father, even then, there might have been a bit more activity of shipbuilding, so on all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, that's very much stilled, and this sort of heritage economy has taken its place. And, you know, I met the sort of living symbol of that, who was a man who used to fit kitchens, big, burly, you know, Geordie bloke, used to fit kitchens, and now is a full-time centurion. And dresses up in Roman armour for a living and does kind of school parties and appears as a figure advertising all sorts of products that are vaguely connected to the northeast's Roman heritage. So there is an ice cream flavour called Roman Britain, produced by the lovely Doddington's Dairy, which is a very nice ice cream manufacturer based in Northumberland. So there's all that going on. Someone once wrote a great paper about the Romanisation of the northeast, the sort of sense that, and that's a joke, you know, because we talk about Romanisation in terms of how Britain became Romanised under the Romans, but there is this curious way in which the modern northeast has adopted this Romanness in quite an interesting way as a way to encourage visitors. And it's, if you like about certain parts of Newcastle near the Roman forts, you'll find that there are some bus stops that have their signage in Latin as well. I mean, it's very peculiar. But so walking along it is fantastic. You know, you've got sort of Cumbria, the Cumbrian end, the Carlisle on the one hand, in the west, obviously, and then Newcastle, the great city, in the east. And then in between those two points, this wild, glorious countryside, and the sense that the wall is on the crest of a wave. In other words, it's on the edge of a volcanic crest. So, you know, this sort of lava that was pushed up between plates or whatever, I'm no geologist, but this sort of, it is like an arrested wave on which the wall perches. And then, and it follows the line of that crest where it can, and then ignoring all geographical features in a very Roman way. It sort of marches in opposition to various other geographical features. Very peculiar thing. And of course, we, you know, it's a sort of lovely, warm feeling to walk along Hadrian's Wall, but, you know, actually you're walking on the site of a kind of rather terrifying military installation. It's all a bit strange.
We often think, because of what Hadrian's Wall was there for, the point of it, this idea that, you know, the Emperor Hadrian had this wall built. I mean, it's often described as, again, this is completely fictionalised, but it was in reaction to the, you know, to the loss of the 9th Legion or whatever in Scotland, and that Hadrian's Wall was the furthest extent of the Roman Empire, and that they never went further than that. But, of course, there's lots of Roman remains in Scotland proper, and indeed another wall, which is much less well-known.
Right, so the Antonine Wall. So after the Emperor Hadrian died, his successor was called Antoninus Pius, and like all new rulers, he needed a bit of a kind of, as is frequent with new rulers, he needed a little bit of a military victory to give him the authority that he required. And so they pushed the border in Britain north to the Forth Clyde line. So it's that narrow waste, 35-mile waste, in the central belt of Scotland, and held that for a generation, and then pulled back. In fact, I think all these, you know, it's a mistake to see these barriers as definitive. You know, I think it's more, I think, well, at least current archaeological thinking is suggests that we should more think about these as zones rather than definitive lines. There's a lot of stuff north of the Antonine Wall. The Emperor Septimius Severus campaigned right up into the northeast of Scotland, and before these walls were built, Agricola, this governor of Britain in 83 AD, conquered the whole of Britain, or at least that's what Tacitus tells us, very briefly, wasn't held on to. So yes, there's a sort of general, perhaps slightly lazy understanding that the Romans got to Hadrian's Wall and no further, but that's not true. And actually, you know, there's lots of good stuff in Scotland, and it's, you know, it's relatively less known about. The Antonine Wall, which I did walk along, is a very different kettle of fish from the Hadrian's Wall. It's not set up as this beautiful tourist attraction in the way that Hadrian's Wall is, largely because, you know, it follows a very contested, it's always a very busy and contested tract of land in Scotland. It's the site of the beginnings of the Scottish Industrial Revolution. There were coal mines there. There is the Forth Clyde Canal there that, you know, you cut into motorway and A road and railway line. So it's a very different experience, and when you walk along it, either you're missing the path of it a lot of the time, you know, going sort of parallel to it, or you are striding ahead into A road traffic. It's very different, and also there's less to see. So although actually there are beautiful bits of it, there are wonderful things to see at certain points. I did find, you know, you're sort of straining with your eyes to try and see where is the line of the wall, because what you're looking at in Scotland is not a wall per se, but a ditch, because the wall was built in turf and there's a ditch beside it, and what's remained is the ditch. So in this curious way, you're talking about the Antonine Wall, if you're walking it, you're kind of looking in the landscape, looking through these fields, looking for a ditch, or even just a little faint kind of dip sometimes, depending on how well-preserved it is. So it's a very curious, it's very solitary, there's no one else walking the wall, sometimes a bit scary because I was doing it on my own, and a couple of moments where I thought I'm going to end up in a mincing machine, you know, and never be seen and heard of again. But yeah, rather interesting.
I want to look at the way recently our perception, our ideas of Roman Britain, especially at these extremes, have changed, I guess, depending on what the situation in modern Britain is. I mean, you talked about the difference of outlook from when Mortimer and Tessa Wheeler were operating, which was firmly in sort of a Britain that held an empire, to how we tend to look at it now as a sort of post-empire place, and we were anti-imperial Britain, cast its sort of ideas over the idea of imperial Rome. And I guess people who haven't been to Hadrian's Wall or have an image in their mind of the actual wall will now probably, in this day and age, be thinking of, you know, Jon Snow on the wall in Game of Thrones or something. And it's like, you know, terrible, awful conditions and a horrible area to be in and to be based. But actually, it seems like it wasn't necessarily like that. And there were people on the wall from Syria and places in the far, you know, far-flung areas of the Roman Empire. But actually, you talk about an incident in the book which comes from York, the northern Roman capital at the time, rather than Hadrian's Wall, of this find of what's called the Ivory Bangle Lady. Well, tell us who she is, and we can then talk about the sort of controversy that kicked up.
Right, so the Ivory Bangle Lady is what archaeologists call the woman who left us a bunch of grave goods. Now, the Ivory Bangle Lady was excavated, a century ago or so, but what she left behind has been human remains, and her belongings have been subject to quite recent research. So the Ivory Bangle Lady, she left, needless to say, there was an ivory bangle involved. So that came from Africa, needless to say. She also had jet stuff, so she had stuff that came from Whitby. Jet comes from Whitby. She had a bracelet that had a little bit of Latin on it that could be interpreted as Christian. So she had a lot of jewels. They were from all over the shop, from Yorkshire to Africa, and possibly Christian. So that's sort of the goods, the grave goods. And then her human remains were subjected to various bits of analysis. To cut a long story short, the analysis suggested that this woman might have been from North Africa or mixed race. Which is not a massive leap, I can assure you, given that, for instance, as you say, York was at a certain point, the northern provincial capital of Britain when Britain was split into a number of different provinces. And Septimius Severus, who was from Libya, was there with his whole imperial train. Now, he was an important Libyan, okay? And just in general, as you've also suggested, this was the whole point about Romanness, is that it's hugely cosmopolitan. There would be people from all parts of the empire in all parts of the empire. But when the Ivory Bangle Lady, her remains live in York in the museum, the lovely museum there, and when they published their findings and the Daily Mail picked up on it, the Daily Mail wrote a sort of alarmingly unsensationalist piece for the Mail. It's a perfectly reasonable article saying, wow, look, there might have been an African in Roman York. The shocking thing is what happened below the line, because there was a sort of avalanche of racism saying, it can't possibly be true, this is a kind of liberal conspiracy, these archaeologists are making it up. But also sort of worse stuff, such as if Britain was multicultural then and then ceased to be, contestable point, and then ceased to be, then we can stop multicultural Britain from being multicultural now. So really nasty stuff. And then it went viral in some various horrible far-right groups in America as well. Mm-hmm. So these sort of nice, well-meaning kind of academic folk at York Museum were suddenly sort of getting all this hate mail, mm-hmm. about the claiming that they had twisted history into an kind of untruthful, meretricious, liberal shape, mm-hmm. and they ought to be ashamed of themselves. And the Mail shut down its comments as well. It's an interesting moment because, if you think Roman Britain is irrelevant and unpolitical and has nothing, mm-hmm. to say to us, then that would be an answer. It's of extreme interest to some people. And the other side of that coin is what York Museum itself was doing, which, mm-hmm. When you go now to the York Museum and look at the Ivory Bangle Lady, you will be shown a reproduction, a re-envisioning of what that woman might have looked like. And she's black. They have chosen to... The archaeology is much more kind of, well, possibly if, it's just possible that, But in the museum, you're shown an image of a sort of North African-looking person. So, mm-hmm. And that's partly to do, and you see this quite a lot now in museums that have to deal with Roman British stuff, mm-hmm. is, how can we make this relevant? What's interesting about this stuff now? Well, what's interesting now is that Roman Britain was multivalent, multinational, multicultural. So that's what we want to show people. And I've got a lot of sympathy with, mm-hmm. that. But it is, if you step back, as of course I've done with this book, it's another iteration of what Roman Britain might mean to us today. And as you suggested, this has gone through many, for every generation, there's been another way of thinking about Roman Britain. And, tiny example, if you're James I and VI of Scotland and, you want to claim Britishness rather than Englishness as a thing, then Roman Britain is quite an interesting place to start. So you get this really interesting, muddled, kind of gorgeous vision of Roman Britain in Cymbeline. We might think about what that means in relation to, the coming referendum. in the mid-19th century, perhaps what becomes a bit more attractive is the notion actually that the Saxons are providing our real kind of urtext for what we as a nation want to be. And then, you know, you get a Gothic rather than neoclassical Houses of Parliament, and you get rhetoric about, you know, we date our British institutions, you know, our real ancestors are these Germanic Saxons with their Germanic qualities that remind us very much of our own dear royal family, mm-hmm. and we can date our institutions from them. Everything else before that is a bit of a throat clearing. But actually, for William Camden, for example, in the late 16th century, he talks about a joyful and mutual ingrafting of the Romans and the British, mm-hmm. that the sense that they, you know, we became one people with the Romans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and there are innumerable and sort of polyvalent iterations of these ideas in different ways.
I'm Irving Finkel, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
It's interesting that, you know, those people that were railing against the perceived modern political correct multiculturalness of the displays in the York Museum and the Bengal lady in the comments on the Daily Mail website, they sort of have accidentally a bit of a point in the fact that this is obviously a modern way of looking at Rome, even though obviously that's inevitably what it was like, because a lot of people now are critical of the idea that, as I said, the 19th and early 20th century archaeologists would have perhaps lionised the idea of the Roman Empire because we had a British Empire. And as you correctly point out in the book, you know, those two things, that's like a sort of false dichotomy anyway, because, you know, they were, you know, the Roman Empire
failed. It's more complicated than that. Yeah, the Roman Empire failed, and whose side are we on? Are we on the Roman side or the British side? So, you know, that becomes a very interesting and strange thing to think with if you're a 19th century British person. And I think, you know, I think we now can talk a little bit in our post-colonial slightly loftiness about our imperial ancestors. It's rather easy for us to decide somehow that they were all raving imperial, you know, they were all kind of infused with imperial ideology. And I'm sure, you know, that just can't have been true, just as it would be absurd to say that all Americans are kind of imperialists. I mean, clearly not. People have complicated, interesting ideas about things and are caught up in national policies that they themselves are not actually personally affecting. Roman Britain complicates rather than simplifies things. So even, you know, even, or as it were, especially for a 19th century person who is marinated in the classics in a way that very few modern educations allow us to be, you know, you can't, it would be very difficult to read a simplistic view of, you know, you can't read Tacitus and think this is all going in one direction. You can't even read Julius Caesar, because it's palpable that he's giving you a very partial account of what actually, and even he can't cover up the fact that Roman Britain was jolly difficult for him, and he never won it. So it's always about turning things, it's always about what lens you're looking through, turning things, you know, things are always a little bit more complicated than you think they are, and, you know, what angle are you going to take on this material today? And it just so happens that the multicultural thing is a convenient, and as I say, I'm very sympathetic to it, because it's true. I mean, it's not like it, those far-right people who got angry about it were wrong. You know, they're not making it up. It's true that not everybody thinks that that research in itself is absolutely 100% secure, because it was very experimental, cutting-edge research. Mm-hmm. But in general, it is absolutely indisputable, indubitable.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look, I mean, there are gravestones that are bilingual in Latin and Palmyrene, which is a Syriac language. There's tons of stuff like that.
And also, I guess what you just described, the idea of Camden saying that, you know, that I want to get to the impossible question of what happened to Roman Britain. There's this idea, I guess, that the Romans came over here from
Rome,
Italy, which is not,
and
you know,
then
didn't
left
exist
400 years later
they all got on the boat and left. But that clearly isn't what happened. Not only was the entire Roman Empire a incredibly multicultural empire, but they left that legacy in Britain, right? Either they didn't leave that legacy, they remained.
Yeah.
The idea, some idea of Rome as a thing, as an empire, disappeared, but clearly a lot of the people stayed behind.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, by the way, all of this is drowned in the mists of uncertainty, because the sources get very, very remote and few and far between, and the archaeology gets very confusing. However, what most people think now is that, yes, there was a gradual withdrawal of troops from Britain because they were needed in other bits of the empire. So, yes, to that extent, people physically moved. But what is this, as you've suggested, by the time, you know, by 400, because Roman rule in Britain ceases in about 408, but 400, every free adult man in Britain was a Roman citizen, regardless of ancestry. You know, they didn't all leave, and they were, you know, they were de facto Roman. However much that was a kind of fusion, or however superficial this Romanness might have been, on paper they're all Roman. And it's hard to imagine that there was a kind of massive kind of exodus of Italian people, and probably very few Italian, maybe a kind of a few civil servants left. But, you know, there's no sort of sense of mass exodus. We, you know, this is a Roman, you know, everyone here is Roman, as I say, on paper. So what happens? And nobody really understands what happens. Or rather, nobody really agrees on exactly what happens. There are various versions, and, you know, as I say, it all gets a bit sort of cloudy and misty. Was it a kind of massive, sudden disaster in which, you know, having been severed from the artery, as it were, between Britain and Rome, having been severed, is there a kind of immediate collapse? Money economy disappears and civil order breaks down and, you know, warlords spring up and so on and so forth. Was it nasty and brutal and bloody and kind of anarchic? Well, maybe it was somewhere. There are signs from the archaeology that in some places there was a certain continuity. And, yeah, from this kind of absence of knowledge springs some of our great storytelling, because from this void comes the idea of King Arthur, mm-hmm. and a sense that there might have been some kind of continuity in the mm-hmm. West. You know, coupled with all this doubt is doubt about exactly in what style and in how many numbers the Saxons appeared. I mean, was that a kind of brutal takeover, or was it a gradual incursion? Was it a rather gentle migration? You know, all these things are up for grabs. You know, I was surprised when this is a period that I didn't know very much about when I started working on the book, and I have to say I was absolutely gobsmacked, to drop into the informal language. I was gobsmacked by how enormous a divergence in very respectable historical views mm-hmm. there was on this. Nobody knows. But as I say, it's a sort of wonderful vacuum, because it creates the space into which that was filled in sort of narrative terms by the Arthurian legends. So that's a plus.
That's a great point for us to finish. So I've been talking to Charlotte Higgins. We've been talking about her book, Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain. So Charlotte, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a huge pleasure.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So I'm on the phone with writer Seth Mnookin. Seth, I've asked you to come up with something for us to talk about, so what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to talk about the Parker novels by a writer named called Richard Stark, and that's one of the many pen names of mystery writer Donald Westlake, who died a couple of years back.
So let's talk about who Donald Westlake was, first of all. As you said yourself, he had numerous pseudonyms.
Yeah, he was he had to have been one of the most prolific mystery writers of the 20th century. And he was, even before he published, he was writing constantly. He started out in the mystery stories for the pulps and ended up several different series, but became well known for mildly comic crime series that he wrote under his own name. And then those were called the Dortmunder books. And then he had at least a dozen different pseudonyms. I've never tried to figure out how many books he published in total.
It's over 100, I think. Yeah, certainly over 100.
Yeah, that would not surprise me.
So the Parker novels are the ones we're particularly going to talk about, and I think there's around 20-ish of them.
Yeah.
People will be familiar
if they've never heard of the writer or even the character, they will be familiar with him because of his appearance in numerous films. Although, interestingly, until the very latest one, which I presume is after Westlake's death, he's never called Parker.
Yeah, he actually wrote 24 Parker novels total. And there was really, as far as I'm concerned, there was really only one movie adaptation that kind of did the character justice and actually was even a half decent movie. And that was a Point Blank that came out in the late 60s, which, if anyone hasn't seen it, is really quite impressive. There was a movie called Payback and is based on the same book that Point Blank was based on. And that's the first of the Parker books, The Hunter. And then there was the one that came out last year, which I was mildly excited about when I saw, I started seeing the commercials, and then that ended up looking horrible also, so I didn't even read it. In Point Blank, Lee Marvin plays the character that is Parker in the books, not Parker in the movies. I think he's named Walker in the movie, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he's Walker in the Lee Marvin.
In the Lee Marvin movie, right.
But I have to say that Point Blank is one of my favorite films of all time. I absolutely, absolutely adore it. It's got this, that great mix of sort of hard-bitten crime, but also it's like incredibly sort of 60s arty and lovely, beautiful cinematography. And it makes LA look amazing as well. Tell us about Parker then, the character. So who is he and what's he like?
So he is, I guess you wouldn't really describe him quite as nihilistic because he does have a worldview that he believes in pretty strongly. It's a fairly amoral worldview, although he does have his own type of morality. But essentially, he is a master thief. And if thieving necessitates killing, that is not a problem at all. He doesn't go out of his way to kill, but it's something that is encountered essentially in every book and sometimes in really, really spectacular ways. And some of the capers that are pulled off, there's one book where he and a gang of thieves that he's assembled try and essentially rob an entire town. And the description of the dynamics between Parker and the other thieves and just the sheer excitement of what's going on, I think those were the two things that really seized me. And it was also, I found really, really satisfying to read crime novels where you weren't rooting for the good guy. You know, I mean, he is clearly someone who you end up rooting for, or at least if you're a fan of the books. But he is also very unambiguously a bad guy.
And there's also, I guess he's the, he's the best of a bad bunch, I guess, is the...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not only he's the best, I think one of the things that appealed to me about him is that it's not just the best of a bad bunch, he's sort of the best at what he does.
Sure.
You know, it kind of, the sense is like in the world, and he's always striving to sort of be better, to plan things better, not because he has some goal of being reaching the platonic ideal of thievery, but just because it makes his life easier. And one of the interesting things about the books is everything always goes wrong, usually because of some other party that screws up horribly.
So he's a professional.
Yes.
But at the same time, there's almost a sense the people that he's against, they're not necessarily even mafiosi, they're businessmen. There's all the point that this is about capitalism as a criminal enterprise rather than, you know, the mob as a criminal enterprise. And that he's just a very, very, very good businessman.
Yeah, a very, very good businessman if business involved, thieving and murder. But yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, he's not, for the most part, he doesn't have grudges. He thinks they're a distraction. And it's not even one thing that's interesting about him is he's not thieving to amass a huge pot of money. What he does is he goes and pulls a caper and then sort of retires to this house that he lives in for X amount of time until he decides that he needs some more money. And then he goes and pulls another caper. But you're definitely right. There's none of the sort of pretending that this is about something deeper than it is than you get in like the Godfather movies or the Sopranos. It's not supposed to be an allegory for life. It is possibly supposed to be an allegory for, you know, our relationship with our work and our relationship with the system of finance. But I think, again, in the way, there's something that's so satisfyingly pure about them And that was one of the things I responded to. And also, when I read them essentially one after another for a year straight when I was working on a book. And it was almost like I would work all day on a book, and this was like mental ginger or something to clear my palate. It just put me in such a different mind frame and such a satisfying mind frame that I really feel like it sort of helped me get through that process.
What book was it you were writing then? Because I'd be interested to know how that...
It was my most recent one. It was The Panic Virus.
Oh, okay, okay. Because I was going to say, you've written about the business of sports, for instance, which I thought would have been a good companion for this.
Yeah, right. No, no, there were... I read these... I mean, I've always loved mysteries, and I've always loved good mysteries. And for some reason, I hadn't... I had read Slayground, which is just an unbelievable book, probably a decade before I got into all of these, and I don't know why I didn't pick up any others. But then when he died, when Westlake died in 2008, there was, and there is, a jazz pianist named Ethan Iverson, who's in a band called The Bad Plus, who was a huge Westlake fan and actually got to know Westlake towards the end of his life, and wrote up this incredible sort of description of all of his books and of everything that was in there. And that was what turned me on to, that was what sort of got me going with the Parker novels.
The obvious place to suggest people start with these would be The Hunter, which is the first one.
Yeah.
But do you have a favorite?
I like the, I mean, I think there's not a lot that builds story to story. You can pick up almost any one of them and not worry about missing anything. But I think there's something that is even more satisfying about reading them in order, because it was, they were published over decades. He would sometimes not write a Barker novel for years and years and years and then come back. I think the last one was not that long before Westlake died, and the first one was in 1966. So 1966 to 2008, you can see this character develop in Westlake's mind, and every now and then there are things that continue from one book to the other. But yeah, The Hunter is a good place to start. Slayground is, it's just so fantastical. It's, the plot is Parker is being chased by some thieves who are actually some thieves in the mob, I think, who are trying to kill him. And essentially this all takes place within a shutdown amusement park. And it's incredible. I mean, it's both kind of absurd and totally gripping and white knuckle exciting.
We've mentioned the films, but there's also a recent graphic novel.
Yes, not just one graphic novel, now a series of graphic novels. And again, that started with The Hunter, the first book. It's let me just look it up. I know his last name is Cook.
Darwin.
Yeah, yes, right. I've only read two of those, both of which I really liked. Let me see how many he now has out. I think he has three or four, and his latest, I believe, is Slayground. Let's see. Yeah, so he has, yeah, I'm not entirely sure how many. He has at least four out so far. They're really great. I mean, you know, the ones that I've read are really great, and from what I hear, all of them are really great.
And these were approved by Westlake, because this is the first time that the character has been called Parker outside of Westlake's own work until the recent Jason Statham movie.
Right. Although it didn't, I believe The Hunter, the first one, didn't come out until not long after Westlake had died. But yeah. Yeah, which is another thing. I mean, you would almost think someone who wrote over 100 books would not be very particular about how his characters were used. But there was, like, obviously something about Parker that Westlake really wanted to keep genuine and pure in some way.
He was also a scriptwriter, because Westlake wrote The Grifters.
Yes.
Which is a great film. But also, apparently there's a lost James Bond script out there somewhere.
Oh, really? That's like the Holy Grail. That's fascinating.
Yeah, he apparently wrote a script to Die Another Day, which was, I mean, an awful film, a terrible,
right,
terrible film. But he's not in any way credited, so nobody has any idea how much of his scripts survived into the finished film. He's not credited, and three or four other screenwriters are.
Am I correct in thinking that The Grifters is based on a Jim Thompson?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So he who actually helped me get through an earlier book, and Yeah, I saw The Grifters sort of when it came out and didn't know either of the writers, and I should probably rewatch it. But yeah.
All right, so that's Donald E. Westlake, or should I say Richard Stark, that we've been talking about, and his Parker novels. So Seth Mnookin, thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And everyone listening, you should immediately go out and get a Parker novel, although I hesitate to say that if you also have work you need to get done, because it's very easy to fall down a rabbit hole with these.
So don't forget then, go to www.audible.co.uk/littleatoms and claim a free audiobook. As I mentioned previously, you can get Under Another Sky by Charlotte Higgins, and there's a random selection of the Parker novels that I've just been talking to Seth Mnookin about. Also, do remember that you can donate directly to the show by going to www.littleatoms.com. A number of people have done just that this week. So I wanted to say a quick thank you to Andreas Borg, Carolyn Bailey, Justin Quirk, Matthew Greenwood, and most especially Morgan Phillips for your kind donations. Cheers, folks.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.